Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, presented by Fidelity Investments Canada, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Naveed Rahman, Institutional Portfolio Manager, joins us to share his outlook on investing in global small caps and discuss fund positioning in the Fidelity Global Intrinsic Value Class. Additionally, Naveed and host Pamela Ritchie hone in on topics such as growth versus value, geographical outlooks in Japan and the US, as well as taking a deeper dive into sector-specific themes. Lastly, Naveed works closely with portfolio manager Joel Tillinghast and provides insights on the conversations they have through the market volatility. Commentary surrounding COVID-19 and financial markets is often changing. This podcast was recorded on October 22, 2020. Do you find yourself wondering how rising debt levels are affecting today's investment decisions? Well, Fidelity portfolio managers David Wolf and David Talk's latest asset allocation paper, Debt is Fine Until It Isn't, is now available. The paper walks you through how David Wolf and David Talk are adjusting their active asset allocation strategies to address the consequences of today's debt-driven markets. You can read the paper at fidelity.ca under the Expert Insights section. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
It'd be great to see you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Pamela. Good to be here.
Yeah, we're always glad to welcome you back. Let's begin, Naveed, if you don't mind, but just sort of getting a sense. You don't sort of look on a macro level necessarily. And is it fair to say that you and Joel and also Salim Hart are sort of looking through the presidential election at this point for investment ideas?
In a word, Pamela, that's correct. We are looking through that. We don't typically invest with an idea of what is going to transpire from a macro perspective. What we try to do, though, is take advantage of mispricings in the market. From our perspective, as we look at the world from a global small cap, small mid cap perspective, the tech sector across up and down the cap spectrum has had a fantastic decade long run, unfettered by regulation. And that is we are seeing increasing signs of that changing, whether it's in the European Union or earlier this week with the U.S. Department of Justice opening an antitrust investigation into Google's monopolistic practices. We'll see how that plays out. But our view is that really unfettered regulatory history of the last 10 years is unlikely to repeat itself. So that's a part of the market we're really cautious on, regardless of what the presidential outcome is.
Right. So interesting. And as you say, there's sort of a couple of different pieces to that. And obviously the valuation side of things. I mean, do you want to just discuss that a little bit more? There's sort of this unfettered regulation, but I mean, prices for almost everything are very high.
Right. And what's interesting is it's not an exact parallel to 1999 in the sense that tech companies today are more profitable than they were in 99. But that is not to say that there are not pockets of excess valuation. I think, you know, maybe an interesting example of this is the largest company in the world today, which we don't hold in the portfolio, Apple. Fantastic company, generates a lot of free cash flow, but I think the viewers on the call today might be surprised to take this into account, which is that over the last 5 years, Apple's free cash flow has actually been flat to declined, while the stock is up close to 400%, 350-400%. Normally, the market doesn't give you those kinds of outcomes. Free cash flow that is flat to declining over a multi-year period, while the stock is up more than threefold. This is happening across the technology spectrum, and even profitable companies are really outperforming more because they're getting revalued from a multiple perspective and less because the earnings are coming through. In contrast, parts of the market, Pamela, that are sensitive to interest rates, sensitive to inflation, are priced as if this is never going to happen again. And again, to reiterate, I've talked to Joel and worked with Joel for more than a decade now. We're not saying it's going to happen tomorrow, inflation is coming. What we're saying is that there's almost a free call option in this part of the market. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, sort of on that, one of the sectors that comes to mind where you're talking about all this, obviously, is financials. And in some cases, people have been very, very, very wary. I'm curious how you look at it.
Sure. And so I think one of the things that we try to think about is what is priced in? The market has almost had a knee-jerk reaction to financials in 2020. They were the heartbeat or the center of the last financial crisis. So we have this reflexive memory that says, oh my gosh, there's a lot of volatility, sell financials. And it's true, interest rates have come down, and that is a headwind, as I'm sure you and our viewers know, for companies that are spread businesses, where they lend long and borrow short, it's a headwind. But at the same time, a lot of financial companies, be it banks, insurance companies, are really well provisioned and have much higher capitalization levels than they have in the past. Our main exposure in the global intrinsic value portfolio is actually in the insurance companies, some of whom have actually been beneficiaries of this crisis. We are in Canada, in the US, around the world, driving a lot less than we did before March 15th. That has the beneficial impact of fewer accidents, less severe accidents, which is actually an interesting tailwind for P&C insurance companies, the likes of which we have some exposure to. In addition to that, the market for insurance, it's getting to be a hard market, as they call it, which is to say that insurance rates are rising. Yesterday, Travelers reported, and I think they had an average rate increase for their business and consumer clients of about 8.5%, which is one of the best markets they've had in many years. So there are pockets within financials that are benefiting, are not hit as hard by interest rates being down, and have this additional tailwind should longer term rates start to come back up at some point to be big beneficiaries.
So I'm curious on one piece within financials, as you say, sort of pockets within financials. So one large pocket within banks, the mortgage side of things, there have been lots of discussions about, concerns about defaults on loans, including mortgages. And then there's sort of this other side of in this time seem to be plowing money into some real assets. I mean, real estate seems to have done very well in certain areas, not so much apartment buildings. And so there's this thought that even if you were about to default on your mortgage, for instance, you just sell your house, which is worth more. There's sort of these subtleties within the financial picture that seem to be coming to the fore. Are there any of those additional ones that interest you or that you could point out?
Sure. ARCs, we have benefited in the portfolio from being exposed to home builders, which have, really rallied sharply since the March deaths of the pandemic crisis. Home building around the world, especially in the U.S., had actually been happening at a lower rate than necessary, really post the financial crisis. And the market is waking up to the fact that as all of us or many of us are working from home for longer periods than we expected, many of us actually have the need for slightly more space. And so this has actually fueled sort of a boom from a housing perspective and a real estate transaction perspective. And so we've owned some of the home builders that have done well, but we have also participated, Pamela, in some of the companies that are in the supply chain there. So companies like a Mohawk, which makes flooring, it's a really dislocated stock from a price and price versus our estimate of value. It's a long-term beneficiary in a fairly consolidated market. So those are some of the things that are, I think, bigger parts of the portfolio. The traditional banks and lending from a mortgage perspective, we have slightly lesser exposure there, not because we don't think housing has legs, but just because we see better value in other parts of the market.
Interesting. Okay. So let's talk about sort of the overall value discussion. you've pointed out some reasons why some of the sort of tech leaders might not have the exact same experience going forward in your view. We also have, it looks like, stimulus for a period of time coming, or, you know, maybe you'll tell us your view on that. But what does that do sort of to this discussion of a rotation? It's been happening a bit. What's your view?
Sure. So a little bit of context here. So we, coming into the pandemic, we had 10 plus years of sort of growth dominance over value. And then we had this really, you know, idiosyncratic, you know, once in a long 100-year sort of event earlier this year, which was sort of a forced digital recession, if you will. Sort of the things that you and I and others on this call like to do outside of the home, we have not been able to do. We've had to have lead digital lives, which have benefited the tech companies. Our view is, this has exacerbated a historically wide dispersion. So the distance between value stocks and the rest of the market are wider than at any time in the last 40 years, including the tech bubble. So that's really interesting to take in into context. And then secondarily, should when, hopefully not if, when a vaccine and therapeutics are approved for broad global distribution, we're going to tilt the balance between all digital to some semblance of a digital plus a real life outside the home. That should benefit a lot of the cyclically exposed companies that we have exposure to in the consumer discretionary sector. Companies like Williams-Sonoma, Lear in the auto supply chain. Some of the financial companies we have exposure to, these companies are discounted at a really meaningful level versus the market. And on top of which, the digital recession, quote unquote, that we've had has really sort of been harder for them to adapt to than the pure tech companies that obviously in many cases didn't skip a beat and actually benefited from what was happening. And we're at, yeah. From where we sit today, sorry, I'll pause there. Maybe we'll take another question.
Well, one thing, because you mentioned some really fascinating pieces in there. One of them I just wanted to ask on consumer discretionary. I mean, as you say, there's sort of, I mean, it's been tough to watch retail within that because it's been going through its own transformation. But I wouldn't mind just some of your comments on how what's left is seems to be going forward and will work. I mean, what do you think about that? Are there examples within? You said Williams and Sonoma was sort of an example of that.
Sure. Yeah. So maybe I'll start with, you know, as value and quality investors, it's good for, I think, all of us to remember that we're not looking for the cheapest stocks per se. So what we don't own in the consumer sector are not the cruise lines that are teetering on the verge of bankruptcy and may or may not make it to the other side of this. What we don't own are the marginal hotel companies that are really cheap and again also close to bankruptcy. Our process, and Joel feels very strongly about this, is to find the best combination of valuation and quality. So cheap companies, but that also generate above average returns, generate free cash flow on a consistent basis. And the companies that meet that criteria for us are companies like Williams-Sonoma that we've been talking about. This is a company that 6 or 7 years ago was purely a bricks and mortar company in the U.S. It is today a company where 55-60% of its revenues come from online sales. The stores are in many cases showrooms, actually. They have pivoted really nicely and own a number of sub-brands that have fantastic growth tailwinds behind them, including West Elm sort of being their fastest growing sub brand. And it doesn't trade at a 30, 35, 40, 50 PE. It generates profits today. It has a decent multiple, and we see a path to growth. And they have navigated this shift from bricks and mortar to online and back and forth really well. So companies like that, like Best Buy, are examples of sort of the intersection of value and quality, not just value in the consumer discretionary sector.
So interesting to hear that. Yeah, they make lovely desks as well. I like them. So I wanted to a little bit, there's so many questions coming in actually. So we're getting, some of them deal with interest within the fund towards Japanese equities, some discussions. I mean, a lot of people have been looking to the Japanese model for equities when interest rates were low, 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 low for so long, how that sort of informs perhaps investing now. But I know Japan is of great interest in terms of the equities for the fund. Can you go into that a little bit?
Sure. And this has been the case, for a number of years. Japan has remained among the most reasonably priced and cash generative equity markets in the world. On top of just being a really rich opportunity set for a value oriented set of investors like us, there have also been structural reforms in Japan that have been helpful to equities. Japan used to be the land of a lot of capital inefficient companies. There have been a number of efforts by the Japanese government to actually improve capital allocation, more shareholder-friendly policies from an openness to share buybacks and dividends. And our holdings in Japan include companies like ITOCHU, a fantastic trading company, the largest trading company in Japan, 8 to 9 times earnings, 3.5% dividend yield. It should manage through this difficult period pretty well with earnings down perhaps it only 9 to 10% and earnings growth back in 2011. Warren Buffett has recently joined the party and disclosed earlier this year that his company, Berkshire Hathaway, took a stake in the Japanese trading companies that we have been investors in. We welcome that. That's a fantastic partner to have. It's a long-term investment. The other companies in Japan that I think will be interesting to the viewers today are we have some exposure to pharmaceutical and retail concepts in Japan. The pharmaceutical business, the retail pharmacies have been consolidating in Japan. There are a handful of companies today, including companies like Cosmos Pharmaceuticals that we have a stake in, that have done, deliver really good value for the for their end customers. And for their shareholders from a kind of a very consistently growing earnings and cash flow profile and benefiting from sort of the increased consolidation of that part of the market.
It's fascinating, all those different examples and points. It covers a number of the questions actually that people are sending in right now. The other is sort of the North American side of things as a more broad category, US small caps. Versus perhaps international small caps, but sort of more of a focus on the American potential for equities in these categories to blast off to an extent. Can you speak to that overall? You kind of have, but there's just some specific questions coming in on more detail.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I think we are broadly speaking, the U.S. small cap market has outperformed most other small cap markets, and when that happens, the valuations become less interesting, broadly speaking. So we have a large amount of exposure to places like Japan because the valuations are more attractive. But within the U.S., there are pockets of opportunity. In the height of the pandemic, among the stocks that we added to meaningfully were companies like Discover Financial and Synchrony Financial. And I mentioned those because Discover actually reported this morning, very strong results actually. Better than expected. Again, we didn't invest in the end of March expecting to get paid, in the middle of October. We generally invest with a longer time horizon. But when we put the capital to work in late March, early April, stocks like Discover and Synchrony, which are consumer credit oriented U.S. Companies that serve middle market, stocks were down 70, 80, 85%. The market had this knee-jerk reaction that those businesses were going to be obliterated. And our careful analysis, and we actually, this is something that Joel actually spent a lot of time with the analysts on. We had a number of meetings where he said, if unemployment, remains at 9, 10, 11% through the end of 20, into the beginning of 21, how well provisioned are these companies? Do they have to raise capital to survive? What is a leverage situation? And we did that because the upside for those companies were fantastic, but we just wanted to make sure that they could weather an elongated downturn. And our analysis told us, that in a number of cases, but not in all cases, that they could, and they were better capitalized, and had the ability to provision for more losses and still see the other side of this and deliver really strong earnings growth. And as it turns out, sort of hopefully, with the stimulus that we've had around the world and that we may continue to have in the U.S., the position of the middle market U.S. consumer has been reasonably good. And they have, these companies like a Discover have been very conservative and have provisioned very aggressively for, the situation not to get better right away. And in fact, the data that they're seeing with loan growth and consumer card balances, the repayments actually being at reasonably good levels, is better than the market expected at the depths of kind of March, April. And that's sort of our process in play. You know, we try to be selective. We're not buying everything that's down, you know, 60, 70%. But many times when this happens, Pamela, the baby is thrown out with the bathwater and you get some really good values at times of distress.
And I think, as you've mentioned before, that area of sort of finance or, you know, of financials is an area where there are still sort of the legacy things tracking back to either credit cards or bank accounts that the e-commerce world has still been on top of to an extent. Like, it's still built out on top of that too. It's just kind of
exactly. That's a really interesting point you raised, because, you know, a portfolio like this, a global intrinsic value portfolio, valuation sensitive, quality oriented, we're generally not associated with being on the cutting edge of technology. However, to your point, you know, one of our bigger holdings, Synchrony Financial, is the credit card processor for PayPal and Amazon, two massive e-commerce businesses that are riding on the back-end processing technology of one of our key holdings. And and this is a way for the portfolio to participate in the increased penetration of e-commerce in a way that makes sense to us from a sensible valuation and cash generation perspective. You know, if you can, one can look and compare and contrast the valuation profile of Synchrony and PayPal, and they probably don't show up on the same page. They're so far apart from a valuation perspective, but they do benefit from the same underlying trends.
Interesting. How do you feel about the question, when? When will you see value, if you want to call it US small caps? I mean, there's various areas within, but when do we see this is always the question, right? What components need to come together for a when?
Yeah. So the cheeky answer is we will know for sure after the fact when and what caused the rotation, because generally speaking, the market rhymes over time. It doesn't repeat itself. And so it's usually a different catalyst each time. However, because the valuations are so stretched, the difference between cheap and expensive stocks are wider than they have been in four decades. I think we feel comfortable saying it's not going to take a lot of seismic shift. And secondarily, a lot of the cheaper companies, both in the U.S. and around the world, have a cyclical orientation to them. So when we get a vaccine that is reasonably efficacious and reasonably widely available, and consumers, which, by the way, are between 65 and 70% of GDP in Canada and in the U.S., when consumers feel comfortable resuming some level of activity sort of outside the home, that should be a real catalyst for reasonably priced, cyclically oriented companies in consumer discretionary, industrials, financials, the kinds of sectors we are overweight. And secondarily, or related to that, it should also result in a slowdown in the hyper growth companies that have benefited from COVID. Joel, our lead portfolio manager, reminds us, and we had a discussion about this yesterday, that, you know, what was interesting was if you look back maybe at the Nifty 50 in the U.S. in the early 70s, it was a growth-led market. Joel identified for us like a handful of companies like IBM, Digital Electronics, which had really high PEs. Many of those companies delivered really strong earnings growth for the next 10 years and yet underperformed the market. So it wasn't so much that we're not saying that companies like Apple are going to be unprofitable. For sure, they will remain profitable. But if the rate of growth decelerates to a level unanticipated by the market, you're going to get multiple contraction from that part of the market. And so that's what's really interesting when these rotations happen. It's not so much that those companies that are in the sweet spot become unprofitable, but they just sort of, they come out of the focus of the market. They go from a 50 PE to a 25 PE is still a high level, but that contraction, you know, is mathematically a really meaningful decline in the total return of those stocks. while you might see cyclical companies in financials, industrials, delivering better than expected earnings growth. And that's one possible way this could happen. Again, if I had a crystal ball, I would keep it to myself, but I'm just kidding. It's hard to be too precise about the when.
So when you do you layer on sort of ESG discussions for the fund, it's mentioned all the time. It's considered to be something that most investors will react to one way or the other, but it's certainly a discussion piece. How does it fit with the stocks that you choose basically for the fund?
So the G part of ESG, the governance part, has been critical to our stock selection from day one. Joel, our lead manager, has been managing money in the U.S. since 1989, and we have always tried to invest in the companies with superior management teams. They treat shareholder capital as if it were their own bank account, and in a very judicious, thoughtful way. So the G has always been important, but we are paying more attention, and Fidelity has a fully fleshed out fundamental and quantitative team looking at ESG for us. And they have, we talked a little bit about Williams-Sonoma. That's one that springs to mind because Joel and I had a call with their chief sustainability officer, just in the last few weeks, and it was good to understand the lead that they had in ESG is sustaining. It's the kind of company that that wants to have a supply chain that is really carefully selected so that there are sustainable wages being paid to the people that are making the furniture or making the fabrics or what have you that the company sells. There's a concerted effort to reduce the packaging from a weight and recyclability perspective. So these are the kinds of things, Pamela, that are good from an ESG halo perspective, but they're also really good from a margin perspective. Williams-Sonoma is shipping things in a more efficient way, 10 to 15% more today than it was 3 or 4 years ago, and that is improving its bottom line. The margins are actually going to improve if they can sustain this on a going forward basis. They started down this path before their competitors, and they're keeping their foot on the gas, as it were. And that's the kind of discussion we are having with more and more of our companies to understand how do they incorporate ESG? How does it fit from a dollars and cents perspective to their longer term plans? And by and large, it's really a win-win. It's very rarely you're going to meet a company that says, we're doing this for ESG. It is hurting our bottom line long term. It's often something that really goes hand in hand.
That's really fascinating to hear, from your perspective as well. Naveed Rahman, great to see you again. So glad that you could join us today, and have a good rest of your week. Look forward to speaking to you again.
Thank you, Pamela. Thank you to all the viewers as well. Appreciate your help and support.
Thank you for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. For more information on future live webcasts, please visit fidelity.ca. Don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice.